So the topic I chose today is the two truths. The two truths, which is kind of funny because we keep an open mind in Zen and we tend to say there is no absolute truth. And yet we have this idea of the two truths. It's a little bit of an esoteric topic, I think, but I'm going to do my best to relate it to our practice right here and right now. So I have, I think, 8 parts. Part 1, the two truths. So there are two kinds of truth. There is relative or worldly truth, samvriti satya, and absolute truth, sometimes called ultimate truth, paramarta satya. So we'll be talking about relative and absolute truth. And I think teachers here talk about the two truths a lot, although we don't always use that name. We may talk about form and emptiness. We may talk about big mind and small mind. Or we may use some other creative terms which are roughly congruent with relative and absolute truth. And I think it's good to talk about the term the two truths since it's used a lot in the literature. And it's a term that can lead to confusion, I think, since it's a dualistic way of talking about something that is essentially non-dualistic. And I'll talk a little bit more about some other types of confusion later. And the two truths is a Madhyamaka concept. If you don't know what Madhyamaka is, don't worry about it. But I want to mention it for those who are familiar with Madhyamaka philosophy or might want to look into it more further. And I'll just say that Madhyamaka was, that school was founded by Nagarjuna, who was one of the greats of Zen teaching about the second century of the Common Era. And it's really central to Mahayana Buddhism, which is what we practice here. Is this still good? Is this still in the same, the right spot? Okay, good. So relative truth, you could say, is about the world of solid objects, forms, human interactions, the real world, you could say, although none of it's really real. It's the world we think is real, you could say. It's this stuff right here. And that's pretty much where we are now, talking with our words interrelating. Objects are solid and real, and they seem to exist apart from other things. An example, Zen Center, Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, is a thing that can be defined. It's a real thing that actually exists. An absolute truth, on the other hand, is about interconnectedness, the world of emptiness. Emptiness and interconnectedness are really the same thing. Emptiness is kind of a bleak term. Interconnectedness is a more sort of joyful and holistic term, I think. Emptiness means things are empty of an existence apart from other things. But emptiness means things do exist in the sense that all things exist in relation to each other. So, from the perspective of absolute truth, things don't really exist apart from other things. Zen Center can't really be defined. What is Zen Center? Is it the building? Is it the people who come to the building? Is it the history of the building? Is it the story? Is it the legal definition? You can't pin it down. Really, it exists only in our minds. And different people would have different ideas of how you define Zen Center, and those ideas may be equally valid. Zen Center is a mental construct. It's something we've chosen to designate as something. Everything we give a name to is a mental construct. It's an attempted imposition of order on things that really are not ordered. And the self is a mental construct. So, absolute truth, actually, that's pretty much where we are right now in this room, too, if we're just awake enough to see it. It may be a little harder to see than relative truth. Part 2, what do the two truths look like with respect to our practice? So, from the perspective of relative truth, we see solid objects, we're individuals, we dwell in our thinking minds. We divide the world up into things. This is the busy mind that you encounter on your cushion and in your day-to-day life. Busy mind likes to stay busy. It likes to name things, think about things, and obsess about things. The conventional way of looking at things is very helpful, unless we take it to extremes. Sometimes we take it to extremes, we think about stuff more than we need to, and this can get so very tiresome. We can obsess and we can worry, and it's just not very helpful. And we need a break from it. Busy mind is fueled by our desires to make order of the world, and our habitual ways of making order from the world. So we seek a break from that. And this brings us to absolute truth. We think maybe there's something more there, something deeper than these simple surface interactions. So it's a different way of seeing, and it happens with Zen practice. And we ask again and again, what is this? What is this allegedly solid object? Is this really a lectern? Is this really something that exists separately from its constituent parts? Or is it something that we've chosen to call a lectern? Does it exist simply because I give it a name? And what about this self? What about this alleged self that I'm carrying around? What about this Ted? What is that? Is it real, or is it something that is made up? So the experience of absolute truth, which we come to when we ask those questions, is something that doesn't really happen with the thinking mind. It happens with an opening of the heart and a kind of receptivity. It happens with a softening of the self. It happens when you let the world be rather than imposing your desires on the world. And it's quite vivid, and it can be a little shocking to let this happen, to really give up the self. But it's liberating. And we can have glimpses of absolute truth whenever we leave the self out of it. Self's pretty dominant. Self shows up all the time. Self is always chattering. But not all the time. I mean, we've got so many moments during the day when it's quiet. And we may have certain activities that we're engaged in where we really let the self go. Maybe we're playing basketball, or maybe we're sewing or something, and we're just so much with the activity that there's no self there at all. Or maybe we're walking ever so carefully on the ice. And that's a pretty good metaphor for today, because you all know this, but if anyone is listening to this talk from far away, I'll tell you that we had this huge amount of snow in February mostly, and now it started to melt. And every day it melts, and every night it freezes. And we just have terrible ice everywhere, and you have to walk so carefully. Getting into Zen Center is not easy, and thank you to everyone who has pitched in and helped to try to make it safe to get into Zen Center. But when you're walking on the ice, you're really paying attention. We've all learned this over the last few days, right? You really pay attention. It's just the ice, and you really don't have time for all of these thoughts and value judgments and things like that. You're really right there. So it's a good metaphor for practice. It's like walking on the ice. That's what you do. You have that much focus. And that's how we get out of the self that thinks the world is real. And you may have glimpses of this on your meditation cushion, of course. You're just being. There are times when there's no you. There's only being. You may have experiences like this repeatedly. You may have kind of an awakening experience or a kensho. It may last for a long time. Experienced practitioners may learn to summon this at will. It may be much more subtle than that. And it's kind of the nature of it, this connection with the absolute, that you're not there to see, you're connecting. So it may be just kind of this subtle realization, like, whoa, I was really absorbed in that. I barely remember what happened there. part three, there is a progression in how we understand the two truths. I think we start out knowing absolute truth. I think when we're born, we're babies, we don't realize we're separate from anything else, and we're not capable of imposing our desires on the world or our way of seeing the world. We don't have that way yet. But then we learn about relative truth. We cry and we realize that brings us food. We realize we have some power to influence the world. We learn we can manipulate the world, and we learn speech and we learn to name things. And pretty soon, we're caught up in our thoughts about the physical world, and we see things in terms of our desires, and we think that's all there is. That's it. This solid world. This is it. Until something happens. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, we enter the door of practice through relative truth. We understand the relative truth. We understand the truth of suffering, our own suffering and that of others. And we wonder if there's a way out of suffering. And if we're lucky enough to encounter good teachings, or maybe we're one of those extraordinary people who can kind of figure this out on our own, we realize that suffering is related to the fact that we see relative truth but not absolute truth. We're missing that aspect of what's going on. And we begin to see that if we can drop our desires, we'll be more in tune with the world as it really is, and we won't suffer as much. And then we encounter absolute truth, and we may have glimpses of it, we may enter it very deeply, and then we have to work out a new arrangement with relative truth. It's a little different being in this world of solid objects now, knowing that they're not really solid. And that's the great adventure. Part four, these are not two different worlds or two different layers in the world. I've been referring to two different worlds, and sometimes I'll talk about two different realms, because of the limitations of language. But it's important to know that really it's the same world, to the extent it's a world at all. It's all the same. It's the same realm being seen in two different ways. And I'm going to quote Gajin Nagao. It might be Nagao. In The Foundational Standpoint of Madhyamaka Philosophy, he says, "Worldly convention and ultimate meaning each encompass the entire world. Worldly convention and ultimate meaning each encompass the entire world." Not two. He's referring to a pitfall that happens with respect to the two truths. We may think there are two different realities or two different layers of reality, that there is a kind of a happy world beyond this one, and our goal is to transcend this world and dwell in the other world. And that's really not true. Nagao also says it's not true that the world is somehow double-layered, as if it were composed of one worldly conventional layer and another ultimately meaningful layer. Absolute truth and relative truth are two aspects of what's going on right now. Each of them is the totality of what's going on right now. We're capable of seeing what's going on now from either viewpoint. That's the essence, I think, of the two truths. People are capable of seeing in two different ways. If I bow to you, maybe you're new to Zen Center and I bow to you, there's the absolute truth of the bowing, which includes everything in the universe. The snow is in there. All of Zen Center is there, in there. All of you, past, present, and future. Everything is here in this bow, because this bow could not be without all of those things. But there's also the relative truth that I'm bowing to you in a conventional way. And it's just you and me having an interaction, and we have a purpose there. And it may be accompanied by thought. Maybe you weren't expecting a bow. Maybe you've never bowed to anyone before, and it's kind of awkward. And it may not seem like all beings are present in the bow. It's just kind of confused and weird. So in bowing, I can come from an enlightened place, which is a place that sees absolute truth. When that happens, the conventional is identified with ultimate meaning. I see that my bow to you is a bow to the entire universe. I can also come from an unenlightened place when I bow, and in that case, the conventional is not identified with ultimate meaning. My bow to you seems awkward and weird, and it's impossible to see that all beings are present. There's kind of a disconnect there. But only one bow happened. One bow that can be seen in two different ways. Part 5. Although there is a progression in understanding from relative to absolute truth, that doesn't mean that there's a kind of hierarchy where one is better than the other. Because often we think that absolute truth is the good one, right? That's the one we want. And if we think that, if we think that relative truth doesn't really matter, it's absolute truth we want, well, then we don't need to care for the world. We can simply exist in the bliss of the absolute. We might even think that suffering in the world doesn't matter, but I think that's a mistaken view. And Nagao says, there is no distinction that would give priority either to ultimate meaning or to worldly convention. And one reason that this confusion happens, he says, is that absolute truth is sometimes referred to as ultimate truth, and ultimate sounds better. So I try to avoid that word ultimate for that reason. Part 6. Because there is no hierarchy, how we act in the world really matters. And I'm going to talk a little bit about something Nagao says in this book. He says, throughout the history of Buddhism, there have been persons who set their hearts on a model of holiness, arhat, in which cessation amounts to reducing the body to ashes and obliterating all consciousness. It's sort of like the ideal is removing oneself from the world and just sort of rising above this world. In the bodhisattva career, one must go beyond such sanctity to immerse oneself once again in the actual world of everyday experience. In the bodhisattva career, the wisdom of a bodhisattva is not merely an inner realization. The five learnings to be cultivated include not only inner meditation, but also such secular studies as grammar, the arts, mathematics, medicine, and logic. Buddhist learning is not limited to religious doctrine, but stresses the need to engage oneself in science and the arts. So concrete and practical knowledge is required of the bodhisattva. And he says elsewhere, wisdom belongs to the realm of ultimate meaning, and skillful means to worldly convention. So worldly convention, world of solid objects, this is where we practice skillful means. The term skillful means is used at least a couple of different ways in Zen, and I think one of them is kind of problematic. Upaya is the Sanskrit term for skillful means, by the way. And one way that it's used is this. This little summary comes from the Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism, by the way. In Chapter 2 of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha introduces the idea of skillful means, and he talks about why it's necessary for him to use various stratagems when he teaches. This is because not everyone is ready to hear the full, complicated truth. So I guess he may tell them something that's oversimplified or maybe a little incomplete out of his compassionate concern for them. This seems a little weird to me. The concept of skillful means has been used extensively by Mahayana teachers to justify innovations in doctrine. The idea is that the Buddha's early teachings were a little bit simplified because people weren't ready to hear the deep teachings yet. But now we're bringing out the deep teachings, the Mahayana, because people are ready. And, I mean, come on, let's be honest. Mahayana does change the Buddha's teaching, and that's propaganda. So that was kind of an aside. But upaya is also used to refer simply to a teacher's skill in expounding the teachings and liberating all beings, and that's the way I'm using it here. And this is exemplified by the many-armed bodhisattva who might have an implement in all these different arms and using different implements in different situations to teach. And I really like the idea of learning various skills as part of bodhisattva practice. A good bodhisattva knows how to fix the roof. He or she knows that the roof really isn't a roof at all, but he or she still knows how to fix it. And I admire those skills greatly. I was just taking a look at my wife's workroom yesterday because we're changing things all around, and it's so organized, and I really admire that. She really puts me to shame. She can do drywall, and she's an electrician, and I think it's wonderful. And I think learning to act skillfully in this world is an important part of our practice, taking care of things in a careful way. And the idea that the Zen practitioner just kind of floats above it all and laughs a lot isn't quite right. I mean, it's kind of right, but it's kind of incomplete. Yes, the Zen practitioner may kind of float above it all and laugh a lot, but at the same time, the practitioner is going to be very serious about everything and take really good care of things. We know it's not a roof, but we're fixing the roof. So the thing is that once you've seen absolute truth, you act from that place. You act here in this world of forms from that place that understands that the world of forms has this aspect where each thing is connected to every other thing. You act from that place. And if you're a leader, you lead from that place. And what does that look like? Well, I think there's some dignity in it and some deliberation and some care. You're not swept away by the immediate concern. Everything is present. The immediate concern and everything are not separate from each other. And if you're not where you can act from that place, if you can't see the absolute right now, well, you act in the same way. You act in imitation of how an enlightened person would act. And that helps you to get to the place where you can see absolute truth. You practice as if, and it becomes eventually just practicing. If I do the morning service 100 times, I may be thinking through the whole thing, not really present, but outwardly I'm doing what the doshi does, what the person next to me does, and eventually it's going to get into my heart and into my bones. And if I don't know how to fix a water leak, I go along and I watch, and someday I'll get it. Part 7, all of this relates to caring for our sangha. And now I get to the part that connects to annual meeting day. So if acting in the world is important, and we can't simply float above it, that has implications, of course, for our responsibility to our sangha, which is what we call our community of practitioners. It's important not only to do the meditation and take the classes and look after our own spiritual development, it's also important, of course, to take care of the practice place. And again, skillful means belongs to the world of worldly convention. A good bodhisattva may want to acquire many skills, such as sending a mass email, asking people for money even, learning something about nonprofit governance, skillful use of tools. Looking after the practicalities of sangha life, making sure that we have a practice place that really works and really works for everyone who wants to come here, for everyone who can benefit from this practice, is our practice as much as Zazen is our practice. And that's why I think it's worthwhile to be involved in Zen Center on multiple levels. And so many of you are. And to so many of you, maybe most of you, this is so totally not news. But I'm saying it anyway. Maybe the philosophical context will be helpful. And sometimes it's good to say the obvious out loud. So there are two ways of seeing. We can approach care for our Sangha as kind of an imposition on our practice, or we can come from that place that recognizes that caring for our Sangha really is the heart of our practice. Part 8, process matters. So it's my great hope that we can continue to approach things in this way, because I think we do. And I think we're very, very good at it. And I think by and large we view taking care of the things of this world, including our practice place, as a wonderful practice opportunity. And I would just like to conclude by saying may we always do that, and may we continue to act with skillful means and with open hearts. So that's what I have to say about the two truths and skillful means. And I'm open to comments if anyone has anything to say. Anya.
I have a question or a comment about your metaphor with the ice.
Yes.
Because for me, being aware, walking on the ice, comes from a place of fear.
Yes.
So I don't know, is it fair to come into this practice from a place of fear? Or is that not, I don't know if I'm stating a question or comment. It's all about motivation.
Yeah, motivation. Yeah, I wasn't thinking about motivation so much. I was thinking about focus and what causes us to focus. When we're fearful, we get incredibly focused, and that degree of focus is something that can be helpful in our meditation practice. But you're right, coming from a place of fear, is that a good way to think about why we're doing this practice? Gee, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, sometimes fear brings us to this practice, right? and we kind of use that. If we're fearful, it's probably good to use that focus. I wouldn't go out sort of looking for that, like, oh, I want to remind myself what it's like to be fearful so I can use that now in my practice, right? And that's kind of what you're getting at. Yeah, we don't need to do that. There are lots of other ways to focus. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, thanks. Mary Beth.
So that reminded me, I read a book, I think it's actually called The End of Fear. It's, but I remember it gave kind of three main ways that we as humans kind of escape these absolute truths, that, you know, we'll die, we don't know when.
Mm-hmm.
You get hurt, you get rejected, you don't have control over it. And so it gave, like, these three main ways that we do that, and it put it in the categories of, like, consumerism or materialism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
More. The second component was religion.
Mm-hmm.
Safety, religion.
Yeah, right.
And then the third way was just detaching, you know, just not getting too connected.
Mm-hmm.
Your speech made me think about that, and even that, like, where, like, the fears can be helpful because it can motivate us, but if we're doing it from a place of kind of trying to escape these truths, mm-hmm. sometimes maybe we're destructive, like,
mm-hmm.
our motivation isn't clear, you know.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Zach?
I heard the term readiness is a way of describing it, being focused on the present moment, so, you know, on the ice, you know, you're ready.
Readiness.
Yeah. Somebody,
yeah.
Ready for whatever they say.
Yeah, yeah. That's good, because it sort of detaches what's going on from the object. It's like, I'm ready for whatever's going to come up. I'm not just sort of reacting to what's in front of me. Does that make sense? Yes.
Could you say a few words about the Thich Nhat Hanh quote that you put on the program?
Oh, I did. Eric, could I borrow the program?
Sure.
Yeah, let's see. What we do not have to transcend the world of dust, Saha, in order to go to some dust-free world called Nirvana. Suffering and Nirvana are of the same substance. If we throw away the world of dust, we will have no nirvana. And I think this really relates to the part of my talk which is about how relative and absolute is not a hierarchy. We don't put absolute above the relative. He's saying, and part of that, you know, there can be an understanding of nirvana and samsara. We have the suffering of this world, and then we have nirvana, which is sort of a separate, better, higher world. And that's kind of an early understanding from early Buddhism. And in Zen, we tend to say that samsara and nirvana are the same. It's not about transcending. It's about recognizing that both are present. So I chose this quote to kind of reinforce that idea. And I also like this because in one of our chants, there's a reference to the Saha world. I don't remember which chant that is. Does anybody remember that? And I've always kind of wondered, what's the Saha world? So now I know it's this world of dust. So if we throw away the world of dust, we will have no nirvana. You know, you can't have just happiness all the time, and you don't even want it. That would be so boring. I mean, that's like, you know, the chocolate chip cookie. You don't want just the chips. You want the cookie because of the contrast, right?
What is the Saha world again?
The world of dust. So I think it's probably just a metaphor for sort of, you know, the world of form. Right, and relating to the dusty mirror of Wei Nung, and that idea that there's that idea that you need to wipe the dust away and transcend it. Yeah. Right, thank you. Yes.
I'm coming back to the same idea about fear and ice, because I was walking on the bike trail, and it was really, really tricky today. And there were other people walking, there was a woman walking her dog, and she got angry with this.
Yes.
And she said, this is a nightmare. I said, no, it's frozen water. That's what it is. That's what it is. So you deal with it as it is, which is not the same as fear. I understand that if I'm not really careful, even with my yak tracks, I will fall. And I've had some life-changing falls to them. So I understand that. I don't know that I would say I do it out of fear. More, I do it out of caring. And those are two different ways of looking at it. Is this a nightmare or is it frozen water?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with a nightmare compared to how do you deal with frozen water? It's very different.
Probably the same.
I mean, approaching with care and compassion, right? I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I would deal with a nightmare.
Yeah. But I can see it.
Yeah, that's fair. I understand.
She was tense because of her anger. She has a dog. And she has a size of dog. Yeah. That's not the right frame of mind.
Did that make her happy when you said that?
Yeah, she got so
Yes.
I had a question about the example of potentially not knowing how to fix a water leak, and if you watch it multiple times, then maybe you will.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that thinking in that mindset can enable us to not actually learn something?
That what can enable us to?
Thinking, like, eventually I'll get it. If I just, like, watch long enough, do you think that that can be enabling to not actually gain, like, skillful means?
Because you're just watching as opposed to actually trying to learn it. Not sure I understand. Yeah. Yeah. That's maybe wasn't a really well thought out example. You know, we think with ritual here, you just keep doing it and eventually you get it in your bones and you know how to do it. And you're coming from a really deep place. You don't need to sort of think about it. That's ritual. But fixing the sink or something, yeah, that's a little different. I mean, there really are definite skills that are needed there. And just watching, you know, may not be enough. You kind of need a different approach. And we value that approach, too. That approach involves thought, thinking, function. So, yeah, that's a good point. That example would have been a better example, I think, if I had talked about sort of getting ritual in your bones and then talked about also how, you know, sometimes you need to take a more active approach
to learn things, because you're not going to get everything by osmosis. Does that kind of reach what? Yeah. Okay. Thanks. And Bernie, and then Eric.
I'm just wondering if maybe the idea of watching and ritual are not as different as we have just said it, because the ritual was to, you know, over-intellectualize it a little bit. The ritual was designed by our sort of forebears in the tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
To produce a kind of result. Yeah. And maybe there was a conscious feedback loop there or not. You know, going through these motions and doing these chants and stuff tends to produce this result, so we're going to keep doing it. And maybe it was emergent, right? Maybe it just sort of happened, and the things that the Sangha did for a long time but didn't produce those results just sort of stopped of their own lack of volition. So I'm just wondering, you know, if the things that you do with the sink that don't stop the leak probably are going to stop of their own volition. And maybe the observation doesn't have to be quite as intellectualized. I don't know.
Seems like pretty fuzzy territory, you know, as to, yeah, thanks. Eric?
I was thinking it's kind of along the line of learning any new skill. So I remember there was some, back when Zen was Chan in China, and I think it was Maha, or this guy who would come and just shout behind students and do these really, really unorthodox things to try to get people to kind of have this sudden enlightenment. And it was this idea of you'd have this experience, and then it would basically cause your paradigm to shift, and then you would have that satori for a brief second, and then it would kind of start to become the roots of which you could build your further practice on. So I think about the sink as kind of in the same realm. You have a sink, you're fixing it, you maybe turn it this way, you realize, oh, it's not righty-tighty, it's lefty-loosey, and then you readjust the sink, and then you realize you take the pipe off and put the new one on, and it's through the simple questioning of your regular practice that you start to learn what's the correct thing, what's not the correct thing. When you're driving, for instance, I remember when I was 16, I learned how to drive stick for the first time. I couldn't get the shift right between the clutch and the acceleration. As I did it more and more, and I would ask questions, and I would kind of start to get, oh, going into second gear is when you want to be turning a corner and you're going slow. Eventually, it became just part of the conscious practice where you don't actually think about it, which to me is kind of that gap between the conscious or the relative truth, which is what you're seeing in front of you, the action you're doing, and then the absolute truth, which is, well, this is one action that's part of a bigger process. It's part of a bigger process. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It does.
The simple questioning in between the action you're doing, and then it's in part of this bigger context. It's two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm. Like a flow.
I mean, one of the things that got me into Zen or any of this practice was martial arts originally. And if you look at any of the really good martial artists from ancient China who practiced wushu, they have this ability to get into what we call a flow state. And part of it is no thought. There's no thought between action and intention.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the same thing I see with practice, is when you feel fear, when you feel anything, you just look at it and go, huh. And then you kind of expand your scope of your thought to include more. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks.